Trendstorm.
Our final topic, picked by you, dear listeners, earlier in a poll on our Facebook page, is Syria, Spheres of Reconstruction, focusing on the geopolitically competitive efforts to rebuild the war-torn Arab Republic. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov dropped a bombshell when he revealed that the UN was dissuading countries from reconstructing Syria, which coincided with the Saudis partially replacing some of America's pulled funding for this initiative in the country's northeast. Moscow's top diplomat claimed that the UN Secretariat issued a secret directive prohibiting anything beyond humanitarian aid to the government-controlled areas of Syria, which would align with the U.S.'s position of refusing to do the same until it sees progress on a so-called political transition that it envisions as paving the way for President Assad's removal from office. The UN denied the existence of this order, but that didn't stop Russia from accusing the US and the UK from going along with this shadowy scheme and therefore impeding the return of refugees to Syria. Washington said on many occasions that it will only provide aid to the opposition held quarters of the country, which of course includes the agriculturally, hydrologically, an energy-rich northeastern Kurdish-controlled corner that has dispatched approximately 2,000 troops to occupy, though Trump is changing that policy by cutting $230 million to Syria after the State Department said that members of the international coalition contributed $300 million to this effort. That includes Saudi Arabia chipping in a whopping $100 million, which accordingly makes the kingdom a major stakeholder in the future of this region, and further complicates the already delicate geopolitical situation there, as the Kurds try to negotiate some level of legally enshrined autonomy during the ongoing UN-mandated constitutional reform process. While it might be politically incorrect to say, it does look like Syria is being divided into spheres of influence. The U.S. and its allies' refusal to assist in all of Syria's reconstruction, possibly encouraged by the reported existence of the secretive UN directive, and only concentrate their efforts on the strategic northeastern part of the country that's under their and their proxy's control, amounts to the weaponization of economic aid. This is hypocritical for more than just the general principle involved, because it shows that these countries really don't want a genuine solution to the refugee crisis that's affected so many of them and was one of the triggers for Brexit. Instead of coming together to resolve the worst crisis of contemporary times, these states are drawing proverbial lines in the sand and trying to lay out their claim for a piece of the post-conflict Syrian pie. Gosh, I gotta say, folks, we've been talking about the possible involvement of Saudi Arabia in Syria for quite a while now, and it looks like they got involved, but not in the way that we expected, not militarily, but economically. So we have a lot of questions swirling about Syria and its post-war future. To help us understand everything a lot better, we're going to be joined by Ms. Nedka Bablico. She's a contributing editor at Eurasia Future.
Trendstorm.
Okay, Nedka, President Assad said in an interview with Russian media in late June that Syria won't allow the West to be part of its reconstruction because of their aggression against his country. Yet, Russia is nevertheless still seeking Western funds for this gargantuan effort. So, how do you explain these divergent policies?
This is an odd instance where the Syrian president and the West are on the same page, although for different reasons. Syria prides itself that prior to 2011, Syria owed virtually no debts to Western financial institutions, and the war has only made Syria more proud of its history of liberal economic contact with the West. The U.S., of course, does not want its business community to invest, as this would be a move away from sanctions as a tool of foreign policy manipulation, and instead it would represent a more Ron Paul style of free international market that both mainstream U.S. parties reject in an atmosphere at a time of America, which is frankly addicted to sanctions. Russia's perspective, on the other hand, is quite different, because Russia would like a military conflict to transition towards a political settlement, which itself would then transition into a gradually normalized business relationship where many nations could and would invest in Syria in ways that created the strength of each individual investor. It would also be a way for Russia to work towards a rapprochement with the U.S., not least because any cooperation with the U.S. in Syria would serve to re-emphasize Russia's geopolitical friendship with Israel, which is one of the few concrete things that Russia and the U.S. actually have in common at this point in time.
Okay, Nadka, well, President Assad earlier estimated that it'll take between $200 to $400 billion to rebuild Syria, which his country's close Russian, Chinese, and Iranian partners obviously can't really provide on their own. So what would be the consequences if other countries refuse to chip in and this goal isn't reached?
At this point in time, it's actually difficult to quantify the real cost of rebuilding, even though the figure is almost certainly around the amount that the Syrian president has mentioned. The key for Syria, I think, is to retrain its army and, you know, the genuine refugee population to actually become employed in the rebuilding of the country. And because reconstruction will actually take, in a way, take a greater united effort than the fight against terrorism, and all hands will literally need to be occupied. Basically, Syria will need as large a workforce as possible to compensate for any shortage of investment. And while Syria's partners can provide a great deal of investment, as they will, because it's unlikely that in the short term anyone else will provide any direct investment, the key, and I can't emphasize this enough, will be from learning from China, in particular on what to do and how to build entire cities from scratch.
Okay, Nadka. Well, then, finally, what can Syria do to increase its economic attractiveness to outside investors and make the most efficient use of whatever reconstruction funds it ends up receiving? And also, Nadka, just as importantly, what future role do you foresee Syria playing in the larger sense of the international economy?
I think it's really quite simple. I mean, the best thing that Syria can do at this point in time is learn from China. There is no other better option. The long-term option is unity with Iraq to form some kind of a united Arab Republic. But obviously, due to the political chaos in Iraq, this is unlikely to happen anytime soon, even though in a reasonable world, it really ought to. If Syria and Iraq unite, instead of oil and other natural resources being stolen by terrorists, warlords, corrupt local political leaders, and in Iraq's case, a corrupt central government, it would be a single state with a large and eventually productive population could actually take advantage of a single set of resources and one single workforce. Syria is the cradle of civilization, and obviously tourism has also been an excellent source of revenue for as long as Syria has existed. But without safety and without stability, without infrastructure, schools, hospitals, etc., there is no economy, and certainly there is no tourism. So to reiterate, the Syrian people have a great responsibility to rebuild their country from scratch, and it's going to be a lengthy and difficult job. But the good news is they have their Chinese partner to learn from.
Nadka, this is a very interesting explanation about the ins and outs of the international competition over Syria's reconstruction and the path forward for the Arab Republic. So thanks again for coming on our show and sharing your views with us. Now we're going to switch over and hear what Mr. Ali Sayed has to say. He's a political researcher and analyst based in Belgium.
Trendstorm.
Okay, Ali, what do you make out of Saudi Arabia replacing a large amount of the aid that the U.S. withdrew from northeastern Syria, and how will the kingdom's expanding economic role in the region influence its ongoing low-intensity rivalry with Turkey?
Well, first, I think we have to view this in the context of the shifting balance of power in general, globally. I mean, the U.S.-backed regional power is being given a head start in the face of an eventual decrease in U.S. presence in the Middle East. At the same time, Saudi Arabia and Israeli rivals are being held back, for the lack of a better word, for as long as possible. Saudi Arabia has a chance right now to take advantage of this opportunity to increase their spheres of influence with this investment, and at the same time also get back at Turkey for It's a big investment base in Qatar. Obviously, this will have negative consequences, and it will further cement the relationship between Turkey, Qatar, Iran, backed by China and Russia. I mean, the relationship has been strained in recent times. And this will help to just further cement that whole bloc.
Okay, then I'd like to ask you about the deepening economic involvement of the U.S.-led coalition in northeastern Syria and the effect that this will have on the prospects of the Kurds successfully negotiating some degree of legally enshrined autonomy during the ongoing constitutional reform process. Because I take it from your previous answer that we're in the midst of very profound geostrategic changes that are creating many opportunities, but also many challenges. And I think one of the most important unresolved questions stemming from the Syrian crisis is the future of the Kurdish occupied regions of the country. So how do you see all of this fitting into the larger context that you just described?
The Saudis this summer have already set up a joint cooperation council in Kurdish regions in Iraq. And I'm hearing of supposed giant investment projects to come there. And they're doing repeating the same procedure now in northeast Syria. I've read and come across a lot of praise for this investment in the Kurdish media. And at the same time, predictably, condemnation for it from the Syrian government. So, I mean, what I can say, in the least, this gives more leverage to the Kurdish leadership, increasing their chances of achieving their goals of democratic, in quotes, democratic and decentralized Syrian government, if not their original goal of an autonomous region with self-rule, like the Iraqi model enjoys.
Okay, so it almost sounds like there's a patterned approach to the establishment of spheres of influence in the Middle East, where pre-existing ethno-regional fault lines like those in Iraq are being exploited by foreign actors in the course of a country's conflict to create these zones outside of the full control of the central authorities. And in this case, with the Syrian example, you have a multitude of international actors like the U.S., France, and of course Saudi Arabia now getting involved here then, right?
Yes, I mean, it looks like a free-for-all. I mean, they're all waiting to grab their piece of Syria, I guess. I think this will be further used by the U.S. with further their agenda without actually being there. I think it works out well for the U.S. and Saudi Arabia at the same time.
Okay, Ali, well, we're talking about this piece of the pie then, but what do they want to do once they have it? I mean, it looks like right now, if we look at the Northeast, it of course has much more natural resource wealth than the rest of the country, and it's also less populated, possibly making it easier to reconstruct and making such efforts comparatively more successful. How would this change the dynamic in post-war Syria if you have a foreign occupied corner of the country, resource-rich and sparsely populated, developing at a different pace and with a different degree of success than the rest of the country? I mean, how would that change things? And what do you make out of this possibility?
Just last Tuesday, Bolton stated that Russia is stuck in Syria, as he says, and that gives the U.S. An advantage over negotiation, the outcome of the fate of Syria. The U.S. is predictably has to become leaner and more cost-effective in the face of rising competition in the global stage anyway. This involves, obviously, empowering regional powers that will further its strategic agenda instead. And this is what we're seeing. The best conditions and chances are being given and being afforded to regional powers backed by the U.S. so that they can grab the biggest chunk of Syria as possible. I mean, they want to increase their influence as much as possible, and the U.S., as the U.S. begins to withdraw its presence from Syria and possibly the Middle East in general, I think it's trying to refocus its energies elsewhere, as the Kurds have also realized.
Ali, this was a comprehensive chat about the geostrategic changes in the world that led to Saudi Arabia partially replacing the U.S. in northeastern Syria and the impact that it'll have on the constitutional reform process and the future of post-war Syria in general. So thanks again for sharing your views with us.
Trendstorm.
Now, folks, if we think back on what both Nedka and Ali share with us today, we can see that, of course, it does look like, unfortunately, spheres of reconstruction are turning into spheres of influence, and that the U.S. and its GCC allies, notably Saudi Arabia, are taking the lead in internally partitioning, for lack of a better word, northeastern Syria from the rest of the country. That being said, though, this is not a doomsday scenario. It might even be unavoidable to a certain extent, but we need to stay focused on what Syria can do in light of this situation and how it can take care of all of its people's development and reconstruction needs. So folks, if you want to sound off and share what you think about this, please send us an email at radio@sputniknews.com or find us on Facebook. And with this, we end this week's edition of Trendstorm, brought to you by Radio Sputnik. It was presented by me, Andrew Kurepko. Thank you for listening, and take care.